Chuck Lavelle is into so many different things. I'm wondering whether he was inspired by what they used to call James Brown, the hardest working man in show business. He's often described as the musical director of the Rolling Stones, and since 1982, he's recorded and toured with the band as their primary keyboard player. Before that, throughout much of the 1970s, he was a member of the Allman Brothers, and then he led his own successful jazz fusion band with three records under his own name. He's currently at work on a tribute recording to the pioneers of the blues piano, and that's just the musical side of his career. Chuck Lavelle is also a committed environmentalist and tree farmer, and the author of several books, most recently Growing a Better America, Smart, Strong, Sustainable, written with J. Marshall Craig and published by Evergreen Arts. I'm very pleased to welcome Chuck Lavelle to our studio, where he is seated at the Steinway piano. Hi, Chuck.
Great to be with you, Leonard. Thanks for inviting me here.
And we'll get to the music in a moment, but what inspired you to become so active as an environmentalist?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, having gone through the cultural revolution of the 60s, the environment was part of that, as you know. And so I think a lot of us of a certain age at that time became interested in environmental concerns.
But is it possible for somebody who's touring to remain green?
Yeah, of course. There's a lot of artists and bands out there that are doing great things. Jack Johnson has a studio that's primarily solar-powered, and a lot of artists, as you know, Willie Nelson, Indigo Girls, and Jack and others use biofuels in their buses and so forth. So there's a lot being done on the entertainment front as a whole. But, you know, I guess I became aware of these concerns back in the 60s, but it lay dormant a while until I met my wife and her family, who have been connected to the land for generations, and as farmers and tending cattle and tending forest lands, and just as a family who had a great passion and love and respect for the land. And in 1981, her grandmother passed away, leaving her about 1,000 acres of land, and it became our responsibility. So I took it seriously. I didn't know a whole lot about it, and I had to take a little self-education journey, went to the library, checked out books, talked to other landowners, went to meetings and seminars, eventually enrolled in a correspondence course when I was touring with the Fabulous Thunderbirds, mm-hmm. a little Texas blues band. This is back in the 80s now. And I began to gain some confidence and focused on forestry because it fit me as a musician. I could follow my career. It wasn't so much day-to-day like row cropping or cattle farming or anything like that. And also I kind of had a few aha moments, reminding myself where this instrument that's giving me my career comes from, the resource of wood, of course. And
a lot of wood went into the piano you're seated at, right?
It absolutely did.
Probably not from a tree farm of the sort you have, but 1,000 acres, that you can grow a lot of trees on that. So well, what do you do, cut down a third and then how long before you can from planting a tree to actually cutting it down?
Well, it's all about sustainable forestry to begin with, of course. And, you know, the different parts of the country have different situations. I'm in the south in Georgia, so primarily southern yellow pine is grown there. Some of the fields that were open that we planted in trees, we did a first thinning somewhere around age 18 or 20. And then we have a very, very long-term view looking, you know, 70, 80 years down the road.
Well, when you think of environmentally sound areas, usually places in the Northwest come to mind immediately, Portland, Seattle areas. But you're in the South. I never really thought that people were thinking particularly green down there.
Well, we do, very
and
much
And there's
so.
A town called Serenbe, which you see as a kind of a model?
Yes, actually Serenbe, and it's a fellow named Steve Nygren put this together. It's quite an interesting story, just briefly. He was a successful restaurateur, and he bought a little country getaway about 30 miles southeast of Atlanta for his family. I think it was started with maybe 10, 15 acres, and then he added on to it. They fell in love with it. They spent more and more time out there. One day, he and his daughter are jogging, and they see the bulldozers coming. And they, you know, oh, boy, here we go. Development's going to eat us up. And he realized, well, look, I can't stop that kind of thing, but maybe I can guide it. And so he went to his neighbors. He started having town meetings and just knocking on doors. And remarkably, he put together over 1,000 acres with a 70-30 ethic, 70% natural lands, 30% development. They have beautiful hiking trails, biking trails. They have an equestrian center. They have an inn that people can come and stay on the weekend. And they have a very well-built earthcraft standard housing and that kind of thing.
What could be done in a city like Detroit, which has a shrinking population and a growing amount of empty space?
Well, it's interesting. It's very hard. You know, we use the term smart decline because that's what's happened in Detroit. But it's very difficult to rip up that concrete and asphalt once it's down. However, here is a city that is doing exactly that. In some cases, they're having to because, you know, some of those neighborhoods, as you're well aware, are just abandoned. They're ghost towns. And I think it'll be an interesting study as time goes on how Detroit handles it. We write about it in my book, as you know, and it will just be a very interesting case and study. I think there's a lot of passion from the people that live in Detroit about getting it right and about going forward in the best possible way. And that offers a lot of hope in my mind.
The book you mentioned is called Growing a Better America, Smart, Strong, Sustainable, written with the help of J. Marshall Craig and published by Evergreen Arts. And I wonder how you can do all of this because you also speak about environmental issues and write about them. Does it take much time away from your career as a musician?
Well, you know, life to me is all about balance, Leonard. And I think when you're passionate about things, you'll find the time. You'll remember the original story of Cheaper by the Dozen. And the father of the family, the large family, if you recall, his job was time management. And that always fascinated me, you know, making the best possible, of the time that you have. And I think that can be done, and I think about that a lot, you know. So I try to it's not just about multitasking, but it's about arranging your life in a way that allows you to do these things.
So you just got out of the studio with John Mayer.
Yes.
You've been touring with him this fall. And then you've been working on a tribute album to pioneering blues piano players from the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Yes, and I'm really excited about this project, the blues project. Well, both, everything. John is an amazing artist, and we have just about completed a record, and I think it'll now be probably January before it comes out and that we start the tour. And it's been a joy to work with John. But the blues project that I'm doing, you know, these are players, Leonard, that a lot of people have never heard of from this era, but they had a huge influence as time went on. I mean, you know, we all know the Jerry Lee Lewis's, the Little Richards, and so forth. But when you look back prior to that, where did they get it from, and where did some of these names like Little Brother Montgomery and Skip James and Leroy Carr?
Jimmy Yancey.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. That's some of the boogie sort of players. You know, you could go to Albert Ammons and Meade Lux Lewis and all that. But I'm focusing on this project mostly on the blues guys. You know, and then bringing it forward enough in the 50s to where you touch on Otis Spann, a great Chicago player, and early Ray Charles. I have an early Ray Charles cut on there.
And you say Ray Charles was a major inspiration.
Oh, he was everything. The story is that when I was probably around 13, or maybe even younger, my older sister Judy had a date in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where we lived and grew up, to go see Ray Charles at the Coliseum there at the university. And my parents had something they were doing, and so they didn't want to leave me there home alone. And they said, well, Judy, take Chuck with you, you know. And she towed me along. And I was already playing music, you know, and enjoying music and interested in it. But, man, I had never seen a band like that, you know, the big band, powerful, Ray singing the Ray Letts.
But this is the new Enlightened South.
Yeah, yeah, well, there was a lot of turmoil going on in that area, as you are well aware of. You know, this was the era when Wallace stood on the steps of the university refusing entrance.
So was this an integrated audience?
Well, you know, I think the folks from my generation that grew up in that era at that time, at least a lot of us, and I think this is very important to understand, my mother was so non-prejudiced, and she drilled that into us, you know. I mean, every day. And so my sister and our family, we didn't have those negative attitudes about race and things. And so, you know, I wound up playing with a great black band from called the Jades, that was from Stillman College there, and worked with a lot of integrated bands at that time.
What are you going to play for us now?
Well, let's do a song that some of the listeners will know, called Statesboro Blues, made popular by the Allman Brothers Band. I'll do a slightly different version of it, but...
Than you did when you were with the band.
Yeah, just slightly different. Here we go.
Chuck Lavelle playing and singing Statesboro Blues. You obviously enjoy the singing. You can't sing with the Rolling Stones. Did you sing with the Allman Brothers?
Well, I did. Of course, Greg Allman was a primary singer, and Dickie Betts was in the band when I was in it, and also did a lot of lead vocals. That's been my dilemma, Leonard. You know, I wind up with these bands with these great singers. You know, I had the honor of working with Eric Clapton, so there you go. But with Eric, for instance, I got to do the counterparts that Jack Bruce used to do on the Cream songs, you know, White Room and that kind of thing. So I'd get little spots here and there.
And we're talking with Chuck Lavelle, who also is the author of a new book called Growing a Better America, Smart, Strong, Sustainable. We'll take a little break and listen to something from his latest CD called Blackburn. Later on today's show, find out what our words for foods reveal about both our culinary and linguistic histories. And in our second hour, this week's Please Explain is all about thunder and lightning. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with Chuck Lavelle. He has written a book called Growing a Better America, Smart, Strong, Sustainable, published by Evergreen Arts. Also, how many, do we know how many records you've appeared on?
Oof, it would be in the hundreds, I think. You know, I've never actually counted that up.
How did your parents react when you dropped out of high school to play music professionally?
Oh, they were very concerned, naturally. You know, they, the situation was this. I was in my senior year of high school, and my family lived in Tuscaloosa, but I had started working in a recording studio in Birmingham. And so back in those days, they had a program called DE, Diversified Education, which was mostly set up for families where usually the son of the family needed was working at a garage and fixing cars or something. So he would go half a day and then have his job, you know, and he had kind of a special situation. Well, amazingly, I happened to arrange that with me working in a recording studio. But I was also playing in a band, and I was missing a lot of school because we would play on the weekends. I'd leave on a Thursday, and I'd be gone, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Sometimes I'd miss Monday. They called me in about halfway through the year, and I said, Chuck, you know, there's a state law that says you have to attend so many days to graduate. Your grades are okay. They're not great, but they're okay. But you know, you've only got two or three more days in the second half of the school year that you can miss, you know. And I was enjoying my career as a musician, and I had to make a tough decision and followed the career. But it worked out.
But being a session musician at the age of 15, weren't people surprised when they saw you? You went on to Muscle Shoals, the legendary Muscle Shoals recording studio.
Did record in Muscle Shoals to a degree. But what I found there, Leonard, was that, you know, there was older, more experienced players already in place, great players, Barry Beckett, Clayton Ivey, and other really good piano players. And they had it kind of locked up, and I realized I was not going to be able to get much work in Muscle Shoals. So Birmingham at the time was a good alternative for me, but really what came into play not long after that was Macon, Georgia, where Capricorn Records had been established. And I went over there because I had a mutual friend that was involved, and it was wide open. You know, they had a booking agency, there was opportunity there, and that's why I moved to Macon.
And then how did you wind up joining the Allman Brothers?
Well, it took a couple of years after I moved to Macon. I went through a couple of different bands and recorded with several artists. I wound up playing with Alex Taylor, who was James Taylor's elder brother, now deceased, unfortunately, but Alex was a good guy. Toured with him for a couple of years, wound up working with Dr. John, and that was my real apprenticeship.
But he's a piano player. How do you work that out?
Well, I was playing organ. And most of the time, well, Mac liked to, you know, originally he was a guitar player before he was a piano player, so Mac Rebenack, for those of you that don't know that Dr. John's real name. But so Mac liked to play guitar occasionally, and I'd hop over on the piano while he did the guitar thing.
And then in 1982, you started working with the Stones, who also had a regular piano player. How did you work that out?
Well, as I understand it, it was Bill Graham who...
Fillmore East and Fillmore West,
yes,
fame.
Your listeners will remember his name, and he was known as the Impresario of Rock, and he promoted rock music all over the country, but largely out on the West Coast, especially in his later years before he died. Well, anyway, he loved the Allman Brothers Band. When I came into the Allmans, I think he looked at me with skepticism. What is a piano player coming into a guitar-oriented band? But I won him over, and we became friends. He later helped me promote my band, Sea Level. Then there was a gap when I didn't see Bill for a couple of years, and he became tour director for the Stones. So as they're preparing for their tour, they wanted to try some new people, and Bill suggested my name. I went up for an audition. I got the gig.
But Ian Stewart was already working with the band, wasn't he?
Yeah, but I think it was largely Stu that got me in. Stu and I... Ian Stewart, for those who may not know that name, was actually a founding member of the Rolling Stones in the very, very early days in the 60s. And eventually he was kind of booted out of the band because he didn't look the part. With one of the managers at that time thought that there was too many in the band, and Stu didn't really look like a rock guy, so they kind of pushed him out. But rather than run away, Stu said, well, I'll stay on and still play if you got, you know, on the records or whatever, and but I'll stay out of the photographs. And he wound up being a logistician for the band as well. He booked the hotels, he handled the equipment and all of that. And Stu knew of me, and so when they got in touch, he was the one that met me at the airport, and we became instant friends.
And this is after Billy Preston also had worked with the band. Yeah.
That's true. Billy Preston, also Nicky Hopkins, the great Nicky Hopkins, whom I got to spend a little time with. I got to spend a little time with Billy as well. But
you've had the most longevity.
Yeah, well, you know, for whatever reasons, you'll have to ask Mick and Keith, I don't know, but I'm glad to have the position. And I do want to say how much I loved Ian Stewart and how much an influence he was on me. You know, you and I were talking earlier about Albert Ammon's Mead, Lux Lewis, and that crowd. Well, it was Stu that turned me on to those guys. You know, when we would be staying in London, he would say, you're not staying in a hotel, you're staying with me. I've got a large record collection and two nice pianos. So, you know, we'd play and listen and we just had a great time.
My guest is Chuck Lavelle. He's seated at our piano. He's here to talk about his career, but also about his book called Growing a Better America, which is published by Evergreen Arts. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Will you play something else for us?
Sure. We talked about the new project, and so I'll do this one the project is called Back to the Woods. Again, it's a tribute to these piano players, blues players from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and this was a Little Brother Montgomery piece called No Special Rider. Hey, Rider, oh, Rider, where have you been so long? Rider, 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 where you been so long? Ain't had no loving child since you been gone. Well, I hate to hear a little kitty when she blows. I hate to hear that kitty when she blows. Set my mind to wander, baby, make me want to go. Hey, now, baby, ain't got no plumb good rider now. Hey, now, darling, ain't got no plumb good rider now. Yeah, seem like my rider done let me in out. Well, the big bell is a-ringing, and the little bell sadly tone. Bell ringing and a little bell sadly tone. And I'm lonely, 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 and a long, long ways from home.
Chuck Lavelle playing a song that was from Little Brother Montgomery called Special Rider, although that sounded very much like C.C. Rider to me as well.
Well, you know,
a lot of these songs are connected, aren't they?
They're cousins. They're definitely cousins. You run across that a lot when you do the research on this. But Little Brother was quite an interesting figure, born in New Orleans and eventually left and played in all kinds of different settings. He played as a solo guy. He played in trios, played in big bands, traveled all over the country. And, you know, he was a very versatile player for his time.
Well, we see that kind of loose association even with the Rolling Stones when they did Love in Vain, the Robert Johnson song,
sure.
And they did a lot of songs initially in their early years that were covers of American soul singers, did their versions of them.
Absolutely, and even to this day, on every tour, we try to pick some kind of cover tune that would be appropriate for us and pay homage. You know, we've done everything from James Brown to you know, to the all the blues guys, you know, Morgan McKinley and Howlin' Wolf and all that crowd.
Well, the record business, excuse me, seems to be dying, but the touring business doesn't. The last Stones tour for the Bigger Bang record took place over a 2-year period and earned, as I understand it, $555 million?
Well, I didn't see that much of it. They didn't let me look at the books, Leonard, but it was...
You're not doing profit sharing?
would you negotiate with Mick Jagger for me? No, I'll tell you, it was incredibly wildly successful. I've heard recently that U2 may have topped it. I don't know. You have to look at the particulars to, if you want to get into that game of how many shows did you do and yada, yada, yada. But it was big business, and you're right. Touring is sustaining a lot of bands now because the recording has fallen off so much. You know, the piracy through downloading is a huge issue, and it's not the same game that we knew not so long ago.
Are you on constant call? Although it's unlikely that they're going to tour again in the near future.
Well, next year marks the 50th anniversary, you know, 2012, and I know the guys have to be at least thinking about it. I don't have anything to announce here today, but I think it would be remarkable to celebrate 50 years of the Rolling Stones, and I hope it happens.
Well, the big thing, of course, is trying to keep it fresh because they don't want to be an oldies act.
That's right, and they never have been. You know, they've never done that. I mean, the last record, Bigger Bang, was out, I guess it's been maybe 5 years ago now. The last product that was put out that was very successful was the reissue of Exile on Main Street. And now it was so successful, and they found a lot of, you know, unreleased tracks that they finished up, and now they're looking at some of the other earlier records to do the same thing.
And you get a nice mention in Keith Richards' recent autobiography. Did you think that was a good read?
I did. I loved it. Fabulous read. Keith is just so honest. He doesn't hold anything back, and he's not guarded whatsoever, and you know, a lot of what he speaks is his opinion, and but, you know, he speaks it very well. I think, you know, his voice came through so realistically and clear in that read. It was marvelous.
You also just finished filming a movie?
I did. Billy Bob Thornton has been a friend for a number of years. He called me up recently, and he said, listen, I'm coming to Georgia. I'm going to do this film. I need a band. Can you help me? And gave me some specifics. And so I got some young guys that he was looking for, and they auditioned. And he called me back. He said, man, that was great. It worked out. Thank you. We don't have a keyboard player. You want the spot? And he said, you know, you were quite frankly, a little old for the part. But sometimes they would have an older guy in the band, you know, an uncle or something. I said, yeah, man, come on. Dress me up. Let's do it.
It's called Jane Mansfield's Car.
Jane Mansfield's Car. And then he came back to me and he said, well, look, there's another scene in a barbershop where you could take a part and you could say a line. He said, it's only one line, but you get to say it to Robert Duvall.
That must have been a thrill.
Yeah, man, I can do that. So,
just one more thing before you go, and I do want you to play a little more for us, if you don't mind. Getting back to the environment, are you concerned about the debate that has opened up today? We're now fighting over fracking, offshore drilling, mountaintop coal removal. It seems like we're moving backward a little bit.
Well, I agree with that, and that's why my partner Joel Babbitt and I a couple of years ago started the Mother Nature Network, MNN.com, our environmental website, that Leonard has been wildly successful. We're getting now over 3 million hits, unique visits, that is, a month, and
wow.
22 million page views a month at MNN. And look, here's the thing. It's great to say that and to say that our site has been successful, but to me, the most important thing is it shows that Americans have a deep, deep concern with these environmental issues.
The book, Growing a Better America, Smart, Strong, Sustainable, written with the help of J. Marshall Craig, published by Evergreen Arts. Chuck Lavelle, thank you so much for being with us. What are you going to take us out with?
Well, this is an early Ray Charles cut from the late 50s. It's called Losing Hand. I gambled on your love, baby, and I got a losing hand.
gambled on your love, baby. And I got a losing hand. Your love keep a changing like the shifting desert sand. While I was playing fair, you played a cheating game. Yeah, while I was playing fair, baby, you played a cheating game. I know you didn't care. I loved you just the same. Treat me, pretty baby, I declare I'll never understand. Yeah, the way that you cheated me, pretty baby, I declare I'll never understand. Gambled on your love, and I got a losing hand.